Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, today, we're recording in front of a gorgeous live audience at the BFI in London as part of our Inspiring Careers in Food events. The auditorium here is fizzing with energy from an army of the best new food talent who've come to explore careers, alongside a set of fantastic employers looking to snap them up. In this episode, we're going to be looking at jobs that have a sustainability angle. So food security and the sustainability of our food supply chains are now major global issues. So in this episode, we want to gain a better understanding of the sustainability challenges we face, what's being done to overcome them, and the kind of work the next generation might be doing if they enter the industry. And I'm delighted to be joined by a brilliant panel of experts from across the food and drink industry to investigate green jobs in a changing world. We have Kate Corley, founder of Verus Strategies and the Future Food Movement. Kate's made it her mission to accelerate climate action in the food and drink industry. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you with us. We also have Henry Hamilton Stubber. He's Chief Operating Officer at Grow Up Farms, a company that's been leading the vertical farming revolution for the last decade. Hello, Henry.
Hi there.
And we have Alistair Trickett, founder of Grassroots Farming, which brings brands and farmers together to promote regenerative agriculture. He is also, as he tells me, a farmer, aren't you?
I am.
Excellent. That's Alistair. So great to have you all on the podcast. Everyone, here is your panel. So first of all, we should start by setting out what we mean. What are we talking about here? But what do we mean by green jobs? Kate, what kind of roles could we be talking about in the food and drinks industry?
Well, I come from this with a slightly different angle in that I believe every job in food needs to be a climate job. And that's certainly at the heart of what we're trying to do with Future Food Movement. I think that we have the technical expertise, we know what we've got to do, we know where we've got to get to, and actually the technology and innovation, and got some guys here that are going to talk about that, it is there, it's in our grasp. But actually what we don't have is the investment into talent, into people like you guys here today to actually come and kind of deliver on it. And so I would say whilst we do need that kind of technical and maybe the academic rigor and expertise, actually what we really need is everybody to kind of put that net zero climate lens on their roles. And that's everything from, you know, people that are working on the shop floor right through to board level, whether you're doing new product development or, you know, working commercial marketing. We need everybody on board with this.
So considering that, how big an issue is it tangibly for companies in the food and drink sector? You know, because we weren't talking about this 5 years ago in any frequency and in the same sort of frequency that we are now. So has the change been dramatic?
It's huge. And it's so integral to a business's success now, because actually it's socially unacceptable. And I think one thing to take away from this is how much power you guys in the room have, actually, both as a consumer, but also as their future talent and employee. You know, reputationally, culturally, this is, you know, business critical. This isn't a nice to have anymore. And actually one of the things that we're increasingly seeing with some of the food businesses that we work with, whether that's retailers or, you know, the people making our food, the food manufacturers, is that there's a real skills gap with the people that are leading these businesses, and they feel very uncomfortable with this issue and what they've got to do. And because they feel uncomfortable, they're therefore not confident to take action. And what we really need to see and encourage is quite courageous leadership, because this is the biggest challenge of our times. And I think particularly the food industry and working so deeply in the food industry, maybe what you didn't see was how incredibly the industry came together over COVID and kept us all fed through the pandemic. So they're perfectly capable of doing it. We just need to see that type of leadership again.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess that's what we're going to hear about right now. The big question that has been asked a lot is how much of what we see is greenwashing? So, Alistair, we've got students in the audience today who want to make a real difference in sustainability. You work with a lot of brands. How can job seekers recognise when a company's really serious about sustainability as opposed to just paying lip service to it? And the accusation of greenwashing is around quite a lot. How much of that is a real problem, or is it just a lazy kind of accusation that's made, do you think?
Well, two very good questions there. The first one around how can you be sure of a company's integrity when you are approaching them for a job and you're interested in them because of their sustainability? I think the first thing to consider is what's the size of the company that you're approaching. So if it's a fairly small company, maybe a fairly new company, then you can look at the founders. Look at the personal integrity of the founders. What have they said publicly about why they've started the company? What do they do before they started the company? Look at other boards they're members of. Look at other groups that they're members of. And you can pretty quickly get a sense of them as individuals. And because it's a small company, the likelihood is that their culture, their personal culture, will permeate through the company culture. So I've certainly found that to be the case with restaurant groups, for example, that even have up to, say, 50 outlets now around the country. If the founders are still very present in the company and they have a personal drive towards sustainability, then you see that filter through. On the second end of the spectrum, though, you've got the really big companies, some of which Kate deals with. So we're talking about the Nestlés or the Unilevers or the sort of the big companies that you don't necessarily hear a lot about as a consumer, but they certainly have control over most of our food. Now, I don't think you should be shy about working for these companies, but they have a lot more challenging dynamics to cope with and to tend with. They're often publicly owned, which means that they are, you can buy shares in them in the stock exchange. And that has a lot of power and a lot of control over how the board then operates and how the company is run. So have a look at the ownership of the company. As a general rule, follow the money. So if you can work out where the money is and what is driving that company, then you get a bit of a better idea. But the big thing on public companies like that is look at their track record. Something that I'm very nervous of, and I think you should be nervous of, is when big companies come out with claims like by 2030, we are going to be 40% X or whatever. And then 5 years down the line, 6 years down the line, they slowly start chipping away at that and then they backpedal on it. And that's very common. So an interesting thing to do is Google what they were saying 5 years ago and see if they're still talking about it now. I think the other part of that question is, just because a company hasn't necessarily had high integrity around sustainability in the past, does it mean that they're going to have high integrity in the future? Because we're at an inflection point now that Kate's talked about. So I wouldn't be nervous about, you know, shaking hands with these big companies, working with companies that have a terrible track record, because actually, arguably, they're the most important companies to work for.
Yeah, I'd also add that you really want another signal for if it's greenwash or not, is the CEO, is the owner, is the MD, whatever size of business, are they personally advocating and talking about what they're doing? Because if they're not, they're not really putting skin in the game. So that's another kind of signal. And everybody's set targets now, but actually, how are they delivering them? Is there a plan behind it? I think that's a really good question to ask. How are you going to achieve your targets? And is there a plan behind it? Because sometimes you scratch beneath the surface and there's no plan.
I think that point on transparency is really important, because if they're not talking about it, there's probably a problem. And if they are talking about it, you actually need to understand, okay, well, so you set that target, where have you got to, and how do they structure themselves internally? From our perspective, as an impact business, we put finance and impact alongside each other. You wouldn't make up your accounts for a good marketing story, and so it's the same with impact. And so how are they reporting on it, and how transparent is it?
Yeah, absolutely. So Emery, now, I mean, Alistair mentioned that, you know, shaking hands with the big companies maybe isn't such a bad idea, because you might be able to have an impact. And I wondered, where do you see people having the biggest impact? Is it starting off with a company that has sustainability at its fore, or actually joining a company that really needs the sustainability to become at its core and changing the course of how they work? I mean, where could you make the biggest impact and come home at night feeling like you've done something useful?
So I'm a little bit biased on this answer. grew up as an impact company. We don't, you know, to the earlier question, we make no distinction between an impact job and a non-impact job, whether it's farm production, R&D, the rocket scientists, open to all salad-based puns, data, finance, etc. Those are all green jobs contributing to our overall mission. So I think you are going to have the greatest impact where you are aligned with the vision and values of that company. That's going to get you out of bed in the morning. That's going to bring your best self to work. So it's going to be a more uphill struggle in the back office green team of a large corporate. But having said that, I acknowledge the fact that their reach is great, and we need people taking on those challenges.
Yeah, but I guess there's a marginal difference in a vast company's bottom line makes a big difference. Okay, we started off on a slightly wary point here. So let's just roll back a little bit and let's find a little bit about your own journeys. So, Kate, did you set out to have a career in this area, or did it just happen to you?
Not at all. I did a politics degree, actually. So I guess I've always had an interest in the people and cultural side. And yeah, my background was, gosh, very corporate communications when this was, and we would vaguely touch on CSR, which was all a bit woolly. And yeah, just my communications and engagement background. And I guess having a personal interest in it is just how it evolved, and then took the leap to, set up my own consultancy as a bit of a passion point. And to be honest, certainly didn't have a vested interest in food at the time, but one of our first clients was a food business. And then once you're in, you're really in, and it's such a brilliant industry. It's fast paced. And actually, if you really care about the big climate and social issues of today, there is no better sector to work in because everybody has to eat. And so you can touch everybody, like, and it's whether you work for a super tanker and you can be part of helping to turn that super tanker, or work for these incredible innovators and startups that can like light the fire. It's an incredible industry. And I think once you're in, the career options, brilliant.
Okay. And if anyone, I'm sure you all know this already, but CSR is corporate social responsibility. Yes, and it's become a big part of reporting. You know, the boards of companies now report on their CSR. So it's become a really big deal. Alistair, what about you? You've got a farming background, haven't you?
No. Well, I actually have a philosophy degree.
Farming thoughts.
Yeah.
There you go. See what I've done there?
You're good at this. Yeah, I have a philosophy degree. I then was in London for 6-7 years working for a big food company, worked in management consultancy, strategy consultancy, marketing before that. And then my family's background is in farming. So I had a call to go back there. So I moved back up to Yorkshire 6 years ago. And I now run the family farm up there, as well as another business, which I'm here representing today.
But the sustainability side of it, has that always been a driving force, or did you discover that when you went back up to Yorkshire?
No, it hasn't. Well, it probably hasn't always been a driving force, because when I left university, I don't know how many years ago it was now, 15 years ago, it was on the radar, but it wasn't massive. Whereas now it is everywhere. It's kind of this lens through which we see everything. And just to build on Kate's point about everybody eats. So if you want to be guaranteed that you're working on something which has an impact on the planet and on climate and on people, then there's no better sector to be in than food. And I would sort of build on that and take a step back and go, there's actually no better sector to be involved with than agriculture, because more or less everything that we consume comes from the land, whether that's your jumper, the clothes that you're wearing, the food that you're eating, the fuel that you're consuming, just, you know, the technology that you're using. It all ends up, it all starts in the ground, whether that's in rocks or whether that's in soil. And everything that these big companies are trying to do is basically they've worked out that all of their really big impacts, all of their really big carbon footprint and sustainability impact come down to the people that are walking around on fields or driving tractors or involved in ag tech. So I'm sort of here to plug that agriculture is not what you think it was when you were reading children's books. It's now actually this thriving, buzzing industry.
There used to be an idea that farmers were the hardest people to change. They were sort of set in traditional ways, but we speak to so many farmers who are doing such exciting things and dealing with technology and data and different world now.
Yeah, it's a really different world. And it's a lovely, I mean, who in the room here has a connection to a farm in any way? Okay, so a few. So there's definitely enough here. You know, you can be going and working for a tech company. So let me give you an example of some tech that we're using on the farm next week. One of the biggest sources of carbon footprint in the food supply industry could probably be traced back to the fertilizers that are used to grow crops. Nitrogen fertilizer is produced basically by burning fossil fuels, but they're really important to apply to crops because they give us the amount of food that we need. However, if we can change, if we can become more efficient in the amount of fertilizer that we use, then we have a really big impact on the carbon footprint of the food that you eat. So it's an important area to work on. So what does some of the technology look like there? So we've got, say, a very big field. So it's a field of like 10 times the size of a football pitch. When we're going along that, before we go on with our sprayer and when we put liquid fertilizer on it, we'll take a satellite image of it, which looks at the amount of chlorophyll in the leaves, so the amount of photosynthesis. That tells us how much crop is in different bits of the field. We then overlay that with some tissue analysis that we've taken from all of the plants around that field. That then goes through an algorithm on an app that produces a new map that then gets transported into the tractor cab. When the tractor driver is then driving the tractor, the sprayer that he's driving is automatically changing the amount of fertilizer that he's putting on the field based on the satellite imagery that we've calculated and all the leaf tissue analysis. Now, that's just like 1% of the amount of ag tech that can be involved in. So you don't necessarily need to be driving the tractor. You don't necessarily, you could have a maths degree and be working on the algorithms, but these are really, really important and exciting areas.
It's almost like you're saying that farming isn't a brutal slog of mud and freezing cold.
Well, that's the fun bit.
No, that is fascinating. So, okay, now, Henry, you've got another an intellectual sort of background, I guess.
Yeah, so we're starting with the degrees. I was a theology degree, so I'm not sure how that links to impact, godly impact, maybe. Then I was in the, I was a corporate lawyer in London, worked for a magic circle firm, which had a quite a large impact on my work-life balance. I don't think the impact of the work I was doing was huge. And so I moved quite quickly to a small renewable energy company in 2012, where we were building and operating bioenergy renewable energy plants. There was the impact that was taking industrial customers and reducing their carbon footprint and reducing their cost base. And then once we'd done that, we started looking at the other side of the coin, saying, okay, from a customer perspective, who needs this to drive their impact? And came together with Grow Up in 2019, and we've been growing leafy greens ever since.
And do you go home at night feeling that much tangibly better about yourself now?
Absolutely. And I talk a lot to our both prospective employees and our team, and that's the unifying piece. It's that is what gets people out of bed in the morning and gets them working incredibly hard towards our mission.
So Kate, what are the biggest challenges facing the food and drinks industry at the moment? Well, look at our beautiful audience here. Where are they likely to have the biggest impact?
Well, from a kind of actual physical impact, it's what these guys are talking about, the agricultural, the sourcing, their supply chain. But I think the biggest issue that I work on and can hopefully influence is actually mindset. And I think it's working with leadership teams and different teams to help them see climate as a huge opportunity rather than just like this negative that it's hard work, they don't understand it. It's actually hugely exciting. And, you know, listening to what you guys are doing, it's really energizing that there are people out there that are fixing the planet and making it the future better. And I think what's really exciting about food is the future of food isn't actually set. And what are we going to be eating? How are we going to be consuming in 5, 6, 7 years' time to hit the big climate targets? And I think to be working in that space and to be challenging mindsets and looking at, well, just because we've always done it like this doesn't mean we can't do it like this. And that's incredibly exciting. But I think, unfortunately, what we're seeing at the moment is what I would call distracted leadership because of all the short-term problems, whether it was, you know, the pandemic, you know, what's happening in Ukraine and now inflation and the cost of living crisis. The climate crisis is being put on the back burner, and genuinely big businesses and business leaders are saying, oh, okay, can we talk about that next month?
Are you actually having conversations that go in those lines?
Yeah.
Whereas it really needs to be part of the conversation anyway.
Yes, it's lots of spiky conversations at the moment. It's hard. And I'm not saying it's not hard out there for business leaders and businesses out there like trying to produce and control costs, but this isn't something that can be put on the back burner. And actually, we need to be dialing up the pressure from all angles. And there's a massive pressure to attract talent. So actually, you guys do have a really important role to play to kind of put that pressure on.
Has there been an element of you being the hippie in the room?
Not so much the hippie. And it infuriates me hugely. I get told I'm too emotional. And I used to try and dial it back. And I don't know whether it's being put out because, unfortunately, most of the people I deal with are a bit middle-aged, pale, male and stale. There's not enough diverse voices at that boardroom table, so we really try and dial that up through Future Food Movement. It's being human. That's what I now I'm quite comfortable and confident, having done this and probably being considered middle-aged, quite confident to remain human and emotional about this, because it is emotional.
Yeah, it's not all gloomy. I think there's a lot of consumer pressure bringing this to the fore and pushing this to the top of board agendas, etc.
Yeah.
You're already seeing that translating through into some of the reporting structures, certainly from an investor-based perspective, that it's no longer, oh, there's some nice greenery, that's great. It's no, this needs to be on a sort of on a par with the returns. So yes, it's challenging.
Now, Henry, you're work is very much a sort of technology area. And Alistair was saying that, that technology is a huge part of farming. Can you tell us a little bit more about the role that technology will play in the food and drinks industry?
I think it already has, and it will continue to play a huge role in the food industry, particularly in agriculture. The vertical farming was born out of that. It will continue to drive innovation and efficiency. And we see that in our production processes. We are continually improving our impacts through the use of technology, be that energy, be it the production process itself, be it the data side, the R&D. So it absolutely has to be the enabler, and it has to be applied in the right way, I think, for the right food and the right processes. There's sort of technology for technology's sake, which doesn't necessarily move you forward, but technology applied in the right way is key to really fundamentally changing the food production system in this country and around the world.
Could you give us an example of technology for technology's sake? What are the things that are deployed that you kind of think, do you really need that?
We haven't seen many in our own production processes because we try to avoid that. but there are certainly a lot of sort of automation, for example, which sometimes is fantastic, but actually in other worlds doesn't actually work yet. And it's getting technology at the right stage of production that you can then deploy effectively.
Yeah. So moving on from technology, let's talk about actually working together with people. Kate, collaboration on tackling climate issues is a big part of your work. How important is it for people entering this field of work to have a collaborative mindset? And as you know, it sounds from your experience that you're often cajoling people, moving them to an area that maybe they don't really want to go.
Yeah, I mean, collaboration is everything, because actually there's no winners or losers in climate. We either all win or we all lose. And the food system, and it is a system, is so interconnected. And this is where you go back to the mindset piece for a lot of businesses, in that they're very competitive. And they're in a very, particularly within the retail supply chain, it's incredibly competitive, and they're encouraged to be competitive because that encourages innovation and, you know, cost savings and efficiencies. But actually, we need a different approach for climate, because we need everybody to work together. You can't have one brilliant business and then the rest is just lagging behind and not doing it. So we do need, it's almost a pre-compete issue, this, and we need much more collaboration. But And we're starting to see some incredible collaboration and different businesses working with each other, and that recognition that they're part of a system. So yeah, it's hugely important.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Alistair, I can imagine that for many people, the motivation for working in this area is preservation of the planet. It may also be because it's a sexy area to work in as well. There you go. Look at our panel, for crying out loud. The question is this enough? Is the moral imperative enough? Because in order to have real impact, do people need to think in a business way? Should this start being about cash, about companies making money from sustainability, or is that drifting from the point?
I don't know. I think you can break that question into two. One is it evil to make money out of sustainability? And the second is, can you achieve sustainability if you don't engage it as a business issue? And I think that we're at a point now where, as Kate was saying, there's so many other pressures that sustainability kind of falls into this, it's important, but it's not urgent box, which means that it always gets pushed down the agenda. So how do you make something urgent as well as important? And I think that there's a link to profitability and there's a link to business. The second element of that is you kind of have to meet these people where they are. So, well, I'm sort of defaulting to talking at boardroom level here. But if you're talking to the boardroom of a company, you don't have very long. They don't have much time. They hate complexity. They need everything to be keep it simple, stupid. But you need to, you know, there's no point fighting fights for the sake of fighting fights. So sometimes you have to compromise, meet them where they are, which means talking business language, link it to profit, link it to growth. Now, the other thing is it evil to make money out of sustainability? No, I don't think so. It's very quickly, does everything fall back into, does it make us money? And I realize I'm sort of slightly contradicting what I've said there, but that's the challenge, is how do we make it something which a company should invest in, because it is a good in and of itself, and they can afford to, without just pursuing growth. And this comes back, I'm sure we could all talk a lot about a growth mindset, and is a growth mindset actually a good thing? It's got us to where we are now, but if you carry on doing everything that got you to where you are now, you know where you're going to end up, which is more of what we've got, which is not what we need. So there's a lot of, I would encourage you to go and read some stuff around, this might sound quite heavy, but growth economics.
Light bedtime reading.
Yeah, some light bedtime reading around, there's a very, very good author called Kate Raworth, and she's written a book called Donut Economics. which is about how we think about growth and the business world and corporates, et cetera, and politics in not in a growth mindset. And that is really where we can hit the sweet spot of sustainability, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Now, our audience here has probably built up a huge debt in their student life. And they're probably thinking, and this isn't a bad thing, is there money to be made from work in sustainability? Is there a trade-off? And this question that I want to ask all of you, is there a trade-off between a good salary and a worthy cause? Do you take a financial hit from caring? Henry,
you absolutely shouldn't do. We want to be attracting the best talent and paying market salaries. And I said before, we don't see a distinction between green jobs and non-green jobs. All of those are green jobs. They're all impactful jobs. They're all contributing. So I really think you should not be doing that. And we need to be moving away from it.
Is that a reality at the same time?
And what I think that depends. For a truly sort of impactful business, that is the reality. I don't think it's the reality necessarily across the piece. And to Alice's point earlier, I think businesses now need to be looking at their broader stakeholder basis. It's not just investor-led, it is the broader stakeholders. And for example, yeah, we're certified B Corp, and that enshrines a broader stakeholder thinking in the business, which then translates into how you recruit and how you pay and the whole economic stack of the business.
Kate, what do you think? I mean, is there a financial hit from doing something that has a moral imperative?
Well, coming from the kind of corporate business angle, no, it's such a desired skill set at the moment. And there is a huge talent gap. There aren't enough people in the marketplace that have got any sustainability credentials or experience behind them, because actually businesses haven't really invested in it. And it's quite a new thing to be able to do any kind of sustainability or climate related degree or, you know, professional development qualification. So there's not enough good people out there. So, you know, and you only have to look at some of the big consultancy and, you know, McKinsey and the PwC. They are investing heavily in building ESG, which is environmental, social, governance and sustainability teams. And they are paying big, big salaries. I mean, sometimes I think, oh, should I like make the jump? But I think, yeah, certainly within big food businesses, I know many that are trying to recruit and struggling at the moment to find people. So they're now looking in-house to kind of train and develop. And from my own perspective, running an agency and consultancy for food, yeah, we've never been busier because this is so business critical now. So it's a brilliant, absolutely brilliant career choice, and you will touch every part of every business.
Okay. Alice, so what about you? Do you take a financial hit from going into sustainability?
Yeah. I mean, it's a spectrum. I think if you want to get, it's easy to make lots of money in this world. And that might sound like a crass thing to say when you've got lots of student debt, but you guys are obviously motivated enough to come to a careers fair. If you want to go and make lots of money, you can go and make lots of money. Go and trade derivatives, like go and code for Google. But that isn't going to make you feel good. And you're not going to look back on your 20s or your 30s and think, God, that was a life well spent. Now, you can then go into the sustainability world. And then there's a spectrum of stuff in there. Like if you go and work for a startup, they might not be able to pay you very much money, but you might get some equity. You know, now, so what's your risk appetite? How important is it to you to make money in the first 5 years of your career? How much money do you need to make? How do you balance what you learn with what you earn? The one thing that's always put me off a job is when I stop learning, not when I stop earning. So I don't know, I guess yes and no, but it's a bit more nuanced than that. I mean, obviously, we're all going to sit here and go, there shouldn't be a penalty associated with working in a green job. And there shouldn't be. And actually, Kate's saying, you know, they're a lot in demand. So, yeah, I wouldn't worry about it. Find the right job is what I would say.
Just out of interest, I'm a complete dinosaur. And so I grew up when I had full grant. How many of you are stressed by the debt that you've got and are thinking that the job that you need to take really needs to start tackling that straight away? Put your hands up if that is the case, that you have the debt anxiety. Just a few hands coming up more and more. So this, I mean, it's a huge impact, isn't it? Okay, so my last question then is, for people here who are thinking, okay, this sounds really exciting, but nuts, I didn't do a degree that had sustainability at its core. What skills can they get? What if they're going to an employer and looking for a sustainability job, what should they be doing? What should people here be thinking about? Should they be researching? Should they just be fascinated by specific subject area? Kate, what skills, not necessarily having done a degree in this, what could they do?
I think going in at, I guess, kind of entry level, it's really just having a passion for it. That will turn the employer on, trust me. And I think, yeah, there's plenty of kind of, once you're in employment, there should be lots of learning and development and professional development opportunities. But it's really just having a passion for it. And there's loads of, like, oh, it sounds really corporate, but like networking type groups that you can get involved in. And it's really kind of, and this sounds just as cringy as well, but building your personal brand as well. Start to go to these networking places, start to connect with people, and, you know, look at work experience, internships, placements, and just start to kind of build your network. And I think where the biggest gap currently for a lot of employers is actually we need creatives and communications and marketeers to really nail this and kind of help sell the sizzle and kind of engage and influence people. That's the biggest gap at the moment, because we've got brilliant technical, you know, engineers, these type of people, but they're struggling to connect with the masses, and we need that for scalability. We need that creativity to kind of provide that firepower.
Okay, that's a pretty comprehensive answer. Alistair and Henry, anything to add to that?
I mean, I'm very similar to Kate. I think it's the passion when we're interviewing prospective candidates that either does or doesn't come across very quickly. People say, "Well, yeah, I do a bit of recycling." Oh, okay, actually, really understanding the sector that you're applying for, really understanding the company that you're applying to. If they're, as Alistair was saying at the beginning, it will be self-evident where they sit from a sort of value, from a values and impact perspective, and that enthusiasm. We hire on much more on culture and that passion than we do on, you know, everyone in this room will be incredibly bright and capable. So specific skills can be learned and developed. What's much harder to change is that fundamental sort of passion and vision.
Now, there's a huge amount to talk about, but we need to throw this open to the audience for questions. If you've got a question, we'd love to hear it. Anyone have a question there for us?
Hi, thanks. That was really interesting. I'm Zoe. I'm studying agri-food marketing and business at Harper Adams. So it's really, really positive to hear the agricultural values and what we're trying to do being promoted. You're talking about leadership in terms of creating sustainability on the agenda. What would you say are some of the key credentials that you'd be looking for somebody to have to be able to get into those leadership roles and stand out in a job application?
So, brilliant question, Zoe. Maybe Kate, would you like to answer that? So you talked a bit earlier about sort of, you know, coming in at the bottom. What about the leadership roles? We've got somebody doing agritech.
Yeah, that is a good question. And it's an interesting one, because actually it's so emerging at leadership level. There aren't any specific call outs I could probably give on it, apart from, again, it is that passion. And actually it is the cultural piece. And I think people, particularly leaders themselves, underestimate how much positive influence and impact they can have just by using their voice. And actually, when you hear a leader talk, it's really inspiring if you like what they're saying. So I think, yeah, people skills are massive in this space and underestimated. So kind of leadership around that influence is key for me, I think, at a leadership level.
Yeah.
Being prepared to put your head above the parapet and be a bit brave.
How do you get bravery lessons? Bit of bravery. There you go. Any other questions?
Hi, I'm Elliot. I'm from King's. I'm studying history and political economy, and I'm doing masters in food security next year at University of Edinburgh. And I can't help but notice, Henry and Alistair, that obviously we've got kind of the new age of food here represented, and well, still new age with food. You were talking about ag tech, but traditional farming. Do you see a conflict between your two methods of farming emerging in the next 20 years or so?
Love that question. Okay, fight it out, you two.
No, absolutely not. This is all
yeah, massive.
this is all part of UK agriculture and how we develop our food system. So we see ourselves sitting alongside, say, traditional agriculture rather than as a differentiator to agriculture. I don't know if that's
safe. Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. No, I don't think there's a conflict. People that do see it as a conflict are probably not willing to change their businesses. But we've got a lot to learn. Everyone's got a lot to learn. So no, I don't see it as a conflict. I see it as a really good thing, innovation.
They were fighting over biscuits in the green room.
Yeah.
So there was somebody down here at the front.
Good morning. My name's Becky. I'm from Bournemouth University. I studied nutrition undergrad and nutrition and behaviour at master's. And I look after the placement students now at Bournemouth University. My question is from a nutritionist perspective. So you talked very much about farming and adding fertilizers to produce crops. At what point do you step in and look at the nutrition of the soil and the quality of the foods that are then being produced?
So there's a lot of recent science out to talking about how what we put on the crops affects the soil health. In general, the more stuff we put on crops, the less healthy the soil is. And then as a result, the less nutritionally dense or nutritionally varied the food is that we eat from it. And so there's some very interesting studies out from the US that say that, and don't quote me on this because the numbers will be wrong, but the general direction is right, that in order to get the same amount of nutrition that we would from a punnet of tomatoes 30 years ago, we have to eat 3 punnets today. And that's because of the way that the food has been grown means there's a lot less biological activity in the soil. So this is something that we're learning about. Now, unfortunately, the reality of, well, what are farmers going to do about it comes down to, well, is it the farmer's job to do something about it? Now, if I'm a good farmer and a good person, then I would think yes, because I would like for whatever I produce to be the best thing possible and to go on and nourish people. However, the challenge is that we already have our backed up against the wall in terms of profitability and labor and just trying to run a business. So if someone is then demanding extra things of a tier in the industry, and that might not be the farmers, it is in this instance, but it just in general, it could be the processors or it could be the distributors or it could be the retailers. Kate works through all layers of the supply chain. That responsibility has got to be shared and there's got to be shared accountability for driving that change through. As a farmer for too long, I've seen it dictated, this is what we must do. You must do this now, you must do this now, you must do this now. But never is there any help given to do it. And the industry has changed in such a way that the margin that the farmer operates on means it is very, very difficult for them to absorb the investment required to make the change.
We've got time for one more question right at the back there.
Thank you very much. My name's Bells. I'm a undergrad student at Roehampton University. I'm studying nutrition and health. I think it's clear that it's quite a challenging area of work to go into. And Kate, you actually mentioned that one of the most important things is your mindset. And I just wondered if you could enlighten us as to some of the things you do on a daily basis to keep a positive mindset and, you know, keep focused on the challenge.
Yeah, good question. Yeah, you need to be really resilient in this role. Yeah, it really matters. And sometimes we are always, are we doing enough? Are we doing enough? And, you know, you see all the latest reports coming out and we're clearly not doing enough. So, but I think probably my biggest support system is my team. So surround yourself with like-minded people and they're like your power bank. So yeah, I'm really lucky and I have an absolutely brilliant team who are completely as invested and as passionate as I am. And also brilliant clients as well. Of course, they can be frustrating that they're not moving fast enough, but actually, it's all people. We're all people, that people connection, just to kind of feel like you're part of a team and you're doing good work. And then also going out to events and meeting different people that are doing brilliant stuff. It's a really inspiring space, but it's not to say it's not really hard. But when things work, it's magic. And that's what keeps you going.
There you go, a little bit of magic. And that's about all we have time for. This has been a really enlightening discussion. So Kate Corley, Henry Hamilton Stubber and Alison Trickett, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. And remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe via your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review? Thank you so much to our guests and to our audience and to you at home for listening.